Good evening, everyone, and welcome to the Simple Actions Group of Alcoholics Anonymous. My name is Brad, and I'm an alcoholic. For those who care to join us, let's open the meeting with the Serenity Prayer. God, grant me serenity to accept the things I cannot change, the courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference. The Simple Actions Group wishes to extend a warm welcome to all in attendance this evening. These premises are non-smoking. Our group is welcome to use this room and the restrooms exclusively, which are up a small flight of stairs across the foyer. At this time, please silence your cell phones. Also, we respectfully ask that those present please refrain from unnecessary moving around the room. This will keep distractions and disturbances to a minimum and allow everyone to listen uninterrupted. This group practices the spiritual foundations of anonymity, singleness of purpose, and effective sponsorship. As a group, we believe that Alcoholics Anonymous provides alcoholics with a set of clear directions on precisely how to recover from the illness of alcoholism on the basis of simple actions. These actions are contained in the book Alcoholics Anonymous. It is the purpose of this meeting to carry that clear message and to focus on precisely how to recover from the illness of alcoholism on the basis of AA Simple Actions. I will now read the preamble. Alcoholics Anonymous is a fellowship of men and women who share their experience, strength, and hope with each other that they may solve their common problem and help others to recover from alcoholism. The only requirement for membership is a desire to stop drinking. There are no dues or fees for AA membership. We are self-supporting through our own contributions. AA is not allied with any sect, denomination, politics, organization, or institution. Does not wish to engage in any controversy, neither endorses nor opposes any causes. Our primary purpose is to stay sober and help other alcoholics to achieve sobriety. The format of this meeting is an open big book step study. As a group, we recognize the power of one alcoholic identifying with another alcoholic, sharing their experience, strength, and hope from the book Alcoholics Anonymous. We encourage you to engage in conversation and ask questions after the meeting pertaining to the step discussed tonight. And this evening, we are discussing the second part of step 9 of the fear and sex inventory. And I'd like you all to please welcome our panel this evening. We have BJ and Mickey. Okay, and if you get a book, you can follow along. I will read the first paragraph, and it is on page 80. And this is for step 9. So the chances are that we have domestic troubles. Perhaps we are mixed up with women in a fashion we wouldn't care to have advertised. We doubt if, in this respect, alcoholics are fundamentally much worse than other people. But drinking does complicate sex relations in the home. After a few years with an alcoholic, a wife gets worn out, resentful, and uncommunicative. How could she be anything else? The husband begins to feel lonely, sorry for himself. He commences to look around in the nightclubs or their equivalent for something besides liquor. Perhaps he is having a secret and exciting affair with the girl who understands. In fairness, we must say that she may understand, but what are we going to do about a thing like that? A man so involved often feels very remorseful at times, especially if he is married to a loyal and courageous girl who has literally gone through hell for him.
My name is BJ. I'm an alcoholic.
BJ.
My sobriety date is April 26, 2015. I have a sponsor, and Simple Actions is my home group. Thanks for having me. So this paragraph really, really resonates with me. Just to qualify myself a little bit and also expand on this paragraph. I was one of those drinkers who liked to hide my drinking a lot. Not totally. I would let you see that I was having two or three drinks, and while you weren't looking, I'd have 8 or 9 more. And I really do care what people think about me. That's like one of my biggest things. And I hid it a lot. You know, I was one of those drinkers who would put liquor in water bottles and act like it was water and stuff like that. And when you turn your back, I'd throw your drink down my gullet and that kind of thing. So that right there shows you, how the dishonesty is really kind of part of me without this program. And honestly, I thought that that kind of behavior didn't hurt anybody but me, so I thought it was okay. And working these steps with a sponsor, particularly step four, showed me where, in fact, my behavior had hurt lots of people. And the big book tells us in step four, if our conduct continues to hurt others, we're going to get drunk again. So that's where steps eight and nine come in really hardcore for me. I am married to that loyal and courageous guy who literally went to help through hell for me, so very qualified to talk about this. My husband was my drinking buddy in college, and he graduated a year before me, and when he graduated, his drinking slowed way down. And when I graduated from college, my drinking kept picking up. So that we did not have that in common, the way our drinking went. And when I drank, I got really verbally abusive, physically violent. The majority of the times I drank, we ended up fighting. And my husband did grow up in a very violent household as a kid, so not really what he wants to be around. but, you know, looking back, I can honestly say that I wasn't really considering him. I was really concerned with what I was getting and what I needed to feel comfortable, and that was drinking at the time. But nevertheless, he stuck with me, and we got engaged, and throughout our relationship, I ended up breaking off our engagement twice to see other people because I accused him of becoming complacent. I needed everything to be in Technicolor all the time. I need for people to prove their affection to me. I need for every day to be this huge burst of romance and just all this stuff. And the longer I drink, the more I need, and I don't know why. I just think that if you play your cards right, life can be awesome all the time. And I accused him of becoming complacent, and I said, you know, I don't want to marry you. There's something better out there. And looking back, the sentence that says, after a few years with an alcoholic, a husband in this case gets worn out, resentful, and uncommunicative. Well, no kidding. Here I am, like it says in a couple paragraphs, literally a tornado roaring through his life. So, you know, without this program, I wouldn't have seen that, but it was all me. It really was. And, you know, he eventually came back to me again. So I did put him through hell. And we were on the brink of divorce when I got to AA. And, you know, more to come. But looking back, I did a couple of things, made a couple of really big life changes to try to control my drinking. One of those was I left my job as a bartender to get a daytime job in my field. Another thing I did was get married. I thought that, you know, maybe getting married would control my drinking. I also thought it would control my behavior, and it really didn't. So I think that's all I have for now. Thanks.
Hi, my name is Mickey, alcoholic.
And Mickey.
My sobriety date is January 7th, 1989. I was 26 years old when I came into Alcoholics Anonymous. At that point in my life, I had three DUIs. I was at a really bad spiritual and emotional bottom, and I just really did not want to do. I did not know what to do. However, I wasn't sure that I wanted to hang out with you guys at all. So I wasn't married when I was drinking and when I came into AA. And my story maybe is a little different because I was raised with four sisters. My younger sister had gotten pregnant when she was 16, and it really caused a big ruckus in our family. So therefore, it kind of put a stigma between me and other women. The other thing is that having four sisters, my sisters were really, really mean. And I thought to myself, I don't want anything to do with them suckers. I mean, I really didn't. So I had this big wall up around me of alcohol that I really didn't date that much. I did a lot of agricultural products, and that kept me really busy. You know what I mean? So I didn't really have time for all that stuff. However, when I was 23 years old, I started dating this girl, and I dated her all the way until I got sober. And it's funny that this topic is on this step. I've had this book for a really long time. I found this in this book today, and I think it's kind of appropriate to read it. So this was right towards the end of my drinking, right? Now, I was also born and raised Catholic, so like sex was not discussed in our family at all, never. Brushed under the carpet. It was horrible. It was so dysfunctional in that respect. So when I did get a girlfriend, I would hang on to them like there was no tomorrow. So I hung on to this girl that it was a true love-hate relationship. This was right at the end of my drinking. This was right at the end of our relationship. It says, I got drunk at Smackwater Jack's, fighting with Lori, broke it off, gave her girlfriend Sue a ride home. She was really hot and wanted to have sex. I blacked out. To this day, I do not know what happened. We did have a hotel. I was late for work the next day, like really late. My stick man Mark called my dad. Him and my dad went to Richmond to fulfill my obligation. He was so disgusted with me, I drove to Richmond as fast as I could, and I blew my truck motor up on the way to Richmond. I cannot believe the stuff that I put him through, and I'm talking about my dad at this point. Consequence, I blew up my motor, blew up my dad, blew up Lori, did not have a clue what happened with her friend Sue. Filled with remorse, loneliness, guilt, horror. It was one of the loneliest places that I had ever gotten to. This was right at my bottom, soon after I got sober. I could not take this hellish torture anymore. So, like BJ was talking about, I mean, that girl Lori had to have known what happened between me and Sue. I don't know what happened between me and Sue because I was in a blackout. But I, it troubles me. It really troubles me. And I felt so horrible because I was a pretty stand-up guy in our relationship. I didn't stray. I didn't do that stuff. And I didn't know whether I did. So she came back to me. We ended up staying together for maybe another couple months or whatever, and then I got sober and I walked away from that relationship. So then I got married in sobriety after I had about 2 years, and I stayed married to that woman, Mary, for 10 years, and we just grew apart. It was really kind of like some mixed signals. I was really having trouble understanding what I should do in a lot of scenarios. So here was one of them. I would call my sponsor and I'd say, I'm really having trouble with this sex stuff because I didn't get married to be alone. My wife's working nights, I'm working days, and I don't know what to do. And he would say, wasn't she working nights when you met her? And I said, yes, sir. And he said, leave her the hell alone then. Let her do what she's going to do. And I did. So anyway, we ended up growing apart, and we ended up separating and finally getting a divorce. Now, in between that and my current wife, I fell madly in love with this girl that was married. And it was horrible. It was such a love-hate thing that I loved her and I hated the fact that she was married. I mean, that was just one of the things that it really took a toll on me. So at the very end, I was praying to God. I was like, please, God, put somebody in my life so I could just walk away from this. I can't walk away. I can't seem to let it go. I don't know what to do. And he put this woman in my life, which is my wife now. So what happened to me was my wife was drinking at the time, and I just played it off like no big deal. Like, I don't care if she's drinking. It's not going to bother me. I can handle this. And it got to the point where I couldn't handle it. I couldn't handle the fact that she was drinking and stuff. So I would break up with her, and I would go back with this other girl. And this is a really funny story. And a really scary one, all in the same sense. So anyway, I was broke up with my wife, Angela, at the time. She was my girlfriend at the time. And we were having this nonchalant phone conversation. And like right out of the blue, she just cornered me on the phone. And she said, "Have you ever been with anyone in the times that we've been apart?" Because we had broken up like 6 or 7 times. And there was this dead silence on the phone, right? I mean, that kind of tells on yourself right there, right? Because I didn't say, "Oh, no, I haven't been with anybody." So I made a split-second decision that I just could not hold this in anymore. And I told her, "Yes, I've been with one person." And all of a sudden, I heard this click, right? So what does an alcoholic do? I call my sponsor. And, or what did I, no, that's not true. I said, she said something, and I said, "Well, what are you going to do?" And she said, "I'm on my way over to your house right now." Click. I was like, "Oh, shit." So I called my sponsor up. I was like, "Jerry," I was like, "I'm in a pickle." He's like, "What's wrong?" I told him what happened. He goes, "Get the hell out of there." Now, if anybody that knows my wife knows that she's a gun-packing, concealed weapons-carrying woman, right? That's what my sponsor knew. He said, "Get the hell out of there." And I just stayed on the phone with him, and I said, "I can't do that." Because, like, finally, it was up. You know, the thing was up. And I knew that I had to stay there. So I went and sat on the front porch, so I was at least in public. So if I was going to get shot, it would be outside my house on the porch. So let me tell you, I've really learned a lot from that horrible situation. Like, we weren't even married or anything, and I broke that woman's heart so bad. It was horrible. And even like coming to this meeting tonight, knowing that I was going to have to dig this back up again, it hurt me like all over again. And I was telling my wife, I'm like, "You can come if you want, but I'd prefer that you didn't, because I didn't want her to have to feel all that stuff all over again." And last night, so we had this time together, and we both had to feel it all over again. Now, the ending was really different. Our evening ended really, really nice last night. And that's after a lot of work in the steps, in the rebuilding the road that I've wrecked. You know, when it says that a wife will be worn out after a couple years with an alcoholic, that doesn't necessarily have to do with sex or any of that stuff. A wife will be worn out with an alcoholic after a couple years just because of the thought processes that I have on a daily basis. Like, it is really hard to keep up with myself. I don't even know why anybody else would want to try. I'm going to stop there.
All right. The second reading starts on page 81. Whatever the situation, we usually have to do something about it. If we are sure our wife does not know, should we tell her? Not always, we think. If she knows in a general way that we've been wild, should we tell her in detail? Undoubtedly, we should admit our fault. She may insist on knowing all the particulars. She will want to know who the woman is and where she is. We feel we ought to say to her that we have no right to involve another person. We are sorry for what we have done, and, God willing, it shall not be repeated. More than that, we cannot do. We have no right to go further. Though there may be justifiable exceptions, and though we wish to lay down no rule of any sort, we have often found this the best course to take.
Yeah, so like I said earlier, my husband grew up in a pretty tumultuous household, and I think as a result, he's not the kind of person who wants to know a bunch of details. He, as a matter of fact, if you start trying to have a serious conversation with him, you'll see him shifting uncomfortably around in his chair. he just wants to move forward. And so when I was drinking, and actually after we were married, I still went out 3 or 4 nights a week sometimes to bars and clubs, sometimes with the girls, whatever. And I started taking off my wedding band and my engagement ring and putting it in my purse. And I would wake up the next morning next to my husband and just feel all this guilt and remorse and just look at this incredible, amazing person who loved me unconditionally, and just I couldn't live with myself. So I told him. And, you know, it was not good. That broke his heart. And looking back, I didn't do that for him. I did it for me. I did it because I was uncomfortable with what I'd done, and I needed to get it off my chest. And what I really should have done was not do it at all. But, you know, I did that for me. And once I got to AA and started working the steps with the sponsor, and by the way, I think that's the most important takeaway from this paragraph, is I took a lot of direction from a sponsor when it came to amends. I can't imagine doing step 9 without a sponsor's direction. As I need that outside perspective, especially when other people are involved. But, you know, we talked a lot about it before all of the amends I've made so far. But what it looks like today is he hasn't asked me about the relationships I had when we weren't together, and I'm not going to tell him unless he asks. I don't need to go to him and say, hey, when we were apart, I dated this person and this person and this person, and here's what it looked like. And that's not going to help him at all. He doesn't need to know that. Now, if he comes to me one day out of the blue and says, hey, by the way, there's something I really need to know, we'll see what happens. I'm really going to have to put that in God's hands, but I don't bring that to his attention. But again, this is the biggest thing here is taking direction from your sponsor and talking about it before you take action, because a lot of times our motives are for us to feel better, and step 8 and 9 are not about us, they're about other people. I have underlined from this paragraph, God willing, it shall not be repeated. So there's this thing called living amends. There's direct amends, where you tell somebody that you were wrong and ask what you can do to make it right, and there's the kind of amends that lasts for all of eternity, where you just continue to do the right thing over and over and over again. And I referenced this in the first paragraph. There's a part of the big book that says if our conduct continues to hurt others, we will surely drink again. So once I identified where I was wrong, whether I make direct amends or not, I don't get to keep doing it. So that's really important to me. With that, I'll pass.
Thanks, BJ. So I like to take the book in context. Like here we are at the 8th and 9th step. So, of course, I have been with my sponsor. The first sponsor that I had him for 25 years. So it was only until probably about 3 or 4 years ago that he passed away. And my sponsor was, he was rock hard as far as the way that AA does things and about the way that we're supposed to do it. So it was really good. And I agree with BJ 100% that, you know, in step four, I figured out where my A-step list was from all the people that I had harmed from my drinking and my actions and my behaviors. And I had a list of people that I had to go to make those amends. Back up for a second for the end of that thing, what happened when Angela came over to my house that night. I was sitting on the porch, and we had put in some landscape lights in my driveway, and we planted some flowers and stuff. And when she showed up that night, she was so mad. When she was walking up that driveway, she turned around, went to the beginning of the driveway, and started pulling up the flowers on the way up to the house. And I said, "Hey, what are you doing?" And she started kind of cackling, kind of laughing, because I scared her. And I kind of had a little bit of peace about that. I was like, wow, maybe she's not as mad as I thought she was. But let me tell you, that girl was so hurt. It was incredible. So she was the type of person that she wanted to know who it was, where she was, wanted to know the details. And I'm so glad that I had a working knowledge of the book, because what I did was I broke the book out and I read her that paragraph that we are sorry for what we have done, God willing, and shall not be repeated. More than that, we cannot do. We have no right to go any further. There may be justifiable exceptions, and though we wish to lay down no rule of any sort, we have found this the best course to take. And I just had to stick to that. I mean, that's what my book said, that this is my Bible for my life. And I wasn't trying to hurt anybody. And the reason, like, if I was in the process of making amends, I would have never tried to buy my own freedom by hurting Angela by telling her what I just told you guys. I did that because she point blank asked me that question. And I just really felt out of, to honor her, that I had to tell her, that I just really had to tell her. And to this day, I don't regret that situation. This is the first time that it's ever really come back up, really since we put that to bed. And I acted really fearful yesterday, and I'm kind of glad now, in retrospect, to be able to see how we both handled it last night together as a married couple. I have always gone to my sponsor before making amends to anybody, because I know that my motives can be in the wrong place at the wrong time. And I try to really stress that to the sponsees that I'm working with, that one of the things, like in early sobriety, for example, I got one when I go make amends to some old girlfriends. Hello. My motives were like way off. My sponsor would be like, move on, let's go hit this one. And I had a name that was on my first A-step list, and it was my sister, my older sister. And we had worked together for a really long time. And I never was able to make amends to her until I had 8 years in recovery. And at 8 years, I went over to her house, and this is when I really knew that I was on the AA beam, was she was the only person that I ever made amends to that didn't chime in about anything that happened that she might have had a part to play in it. And you know what? I didn't need it. Because I knew that I was there to clean off my side of the street and sweep away my debris. And I wasn't worried about what she had, what her part was in that at all. From that point, we were able to build somewhat of a relationship, but it's always been strained. That's just the nature of me and that particular sibling anyway. But anyway, thanks for letting me share.
Thanks for sharing.
All right, we're going to pick up on page 82. If we have no such complication, there is plenty we should do at home. Sometimes we hear an alcoholic say that the only thing he needs to do is to keep sober. Certainly he must keep sober, for there will be no home if he doesn't. But he is yet a long way from making good to the wife or parents whom for years he has so shockingly treated. Passing all understanding is the patience mothers and wives have with alcoholics. Had this not been so, many of us would have no homes today, would perhaps be dead. The alcoholic is like a tornado roaring his way through the lives of others. Hearts are broken, sweet relationships are dead, affections have been uprooted, selfish and inconsiderate habits have kept the home in turmoil. We feel a man is unthinking when he says that sobriety is enough. He is like the farmer who came up out of his cyclone cellar to find his home ruined. To his wife he remarked, "Don't see anything the matter here, Ma. Ain't it grand? The wind stopped blowing."
Yeah, there's plenty we should do at home refers to those living amends. It's not anything we can do in one day or through one phrase. It's something that we have to start walking in the right direction. And one of the first suggestions my sponsor ever made to me, we had been talking on the phone for a few days, maybe a week or two, and I think she had started to get a sense of how things were in our home and how I treated my husband. And she made the simple suggestion to me, you know, next time you feel the urge to give him some constructive criticism or something of that sort, why don't you just try keeping your mouth shut? She wasn't rude about it, just try saying nothing. And you might have to pray. You might have to ask your higher power to give you that ability, and I did. So I started to practice that each and every day, starting from my first couple weeks of sobriety. And it has been a practice ever since. I never do it perfectly, but I think just the fact that's a huge change in my conduct towards my husband is not henpecking him about everything. You know, I don't need to make a comment about every single thing he does that doesn't jive with my idea of what should be going on. And you know, there I can have love, patience, and tolerance towards him, but a lot of times I do have to pray for that because A, I don't know what it looks like, and B, I have no idea how to do it. If I could have done that, I would have done it long before now. But that being said, that's part of my direct amends. But maybe a year or so into sobriety, we talked about it, and I ended up making direct amends to him. And all of my direct amends have had one thing in common. I've had spiritual experiences each time, and every time I make direct amends, I'm always nervous about how to initiate it. Like, where do we start talking? And every single time, God, like, puts this huge billboard that says, now. Like, here it is. Here's your opening. Go. And so one night, my husband and I were sitting on the sofas, just talking and hanging out, and I was thinking, I was prepared to make direct amends with him, so I was like, all right, this is it. And before I could open my mouth, he cut the TV on, and I was like, dang it. Well, he cut it on to, it was like, I think CSI or something like that. And it was an episode where the main character, one of his ex-girlfriends kept trying and trying and trying to get a hold of him. And he kept ignoring her. It'd been a long day. And he walks into his apartment and snaps on the lights. And his ex-girlfriend is sitting in the corner of his living room creepily. And she's like, "Hi, I really need to talk to you. Sit down." And he's like, okay, what's going on? And she says, "Well, I'm in recovery. I'm clean and sober, and I was really inconsiderate when we were together, and I need to make amends to you." And I was like, whoa. So there was my billboard. So I was like, this is going to be good. God put like a big flashing light on this one. So commercial break, I made direct amends to him. And I told him, you know, that I'd been inconsiderate and I was wrong, and was there anything that he wanted to say? And he was like, nope. And I was like, wow, really? And like, I was kind of disappointed. I was like waiting for this upheaval again so that I could feel better. But I was like, all right, well, just know that if anything ever comes to mind, I'm here. Please be open with me. And he was like, okay, thank you. And that was that. And I continued to, I guess, grow in respecting him and keeping my mouth shut and all that jazz, which, again, I never do perfectly, but better than it used to be. And I didn't really see any change. Like, I can tell you that our relationship got better almost immediately when I came to AA. I know that's not everybody's experience, but today, after a little over 2 years of sobriety, my husband's my best friend, and we're doing well. It's just my experience. But about a year after making those amends to him, we were sitting at the breakfast nook one day, and my cell phone was sitting on the breakfast table, and it buzzed. And another sketchy thing I used to do before I got to AA was put false names in my phone. And he did catch on to that. So my phone buzzed. It was probably one of my AA girlfriends or something. And he looked at me, and this is so not my husband. And he said, "You would never hide anything from me, would you?" And I was like, whoa, this is big. So very, like, I took a deep breath, and I said a prayer with my eyes open. I said, God, this is all you, man. And what came out of my mouth was, no, I wouldn't. I'm not that person anymore. And he looked at me, and he said, I know. And he believed me. And the fact that he felt comfortable asking me that question, that was 2 years of flying right. And it took that long for him to feel comfortable enough to open up to me that much. But, like, that's a thing. Like, that never would have happened without this amends process. And that's not for me. That's for him. That's 7 years of me breaking his confidence over and over. 2 years of rebuilding his trust are starting to work. And that just freaking, that's awesome. And I'm not done. we could be alive and married for 50 more years. Who knows? All I got is today, but, you know, it's incredible. And to see him open up like that was a huge deal. And, you know, it shows me where the program's working and that living amends is doing something. And it's very encouraging to keep going, you know. And I know, you know, there are days where I do start henpecking and stuff like that. And in it, I have to pray for patience, love, and tolerance. Because a sink full of dishes isn't worth spoiling a happy marriage. That's all I have for that.
So I made all my direct amends that was on my A-step list over time. That when I got to my eighth year, I made that one to my sister, and that was off my first list. However, I'm not one of those people that think that, you know, like, I could just go through the steps one time and I'm done. You know, one of the things that my sponsor promoted over and over was, you know, there's no race here. That when you get to 12, you automatically had to go back to 1. So it's like a continuous circle. So that list kind of gets created over and over again. And I have to continue to look at my behaviors. And but I'll tell you, this is one thing that I made that direct amends to Angela, and I live up to the best of my ability. But one of the things that my sponsor did was he said that you need to make a living amends to her. So we had to pick a couple things that I have to do without actually telling her that that's why I'm doing it. But here's how he set it up. He's like, I know that you really like to have your car and your motorcycle clean, right? And my wife's got a car and a motorcycle. And he goes, on the weekend, you have to clean hers first before you can get to yours, right? Like, this has been a 15-year chore so far, right? Like, she has never, like, washed or waxed her car or motorcycle. And that's part of my deal, that I just had to continue to keep doing that stuff. And sometimes I don't like it because I'm selfish. I just want to go out there on a Saturday. I want to clean my car and be done with it. But it's actually a pretty good deal that I like the way he set it up, because if I do hers first and I'm too tired to finish, at least I got hers done. And that makes me feel a lot better about me, because I am a selfish little son of a gun when it comes to things of that nature. And I'll tell you another thing that happened to me about amends. When I was 9 months sober, I went to my parents' house and I laid it all out on the table, and I was like, okay, I'm ready. Here's where I'm at. I'm on the ninth step. And I explained it to them. I said, I'm ready to make direct amends to you guys for all the trouble that I've caused you over the years. And they said, we've talked about this, and we think that it would be way more painful to relive all the things that you put us through, so that your amends to us would be that as long as you never are the same person anymore, then that would be amends enough. I was like, are you positive about that? So I'm like ready to do it now. And they said, no, we're done. We're good with that. Now, so to my ability, best of my ability, I had never was the same person again. I've never been the same person ever since I came into AA. Thank God for AA. It definitely saved my life, turned me around to a totally different person. It's absolutely night and day. However, here's what happened. My parents got divorced. My dad remarried this other woman. My mom passed away. Then the person that my dad remarried passed away, and then he's with this other woman now. So I was having some issues with my dad, and I called up his girlfriend, and I wanted to kind of brief her because they live together. And I said, look, I just want to let you know that I think I need to have a talk with him, and here's why. And she said, well, I agree with you. Go ahead and have the talk. And I said, no, you don't understand. I said, he's going to be so freaking miserable that your house is going to be upside down. And she said, I'm a big girl. She said, have the talk. And then she said, I do have to tell you one thing. And I said, what's that, Marion? And she said, your dad loves you to death. She said, but one thing that really upsets him is that you have never, ever said anything about being sorry or anything for the stuff that you did when you were drinking. And I said, really? He said that? And she said, yeah. So I told her the story. And she said, funny, he never mentioned any of that stuff about sitting at the table. So I was at this retreat. This was really troubling me. I mean, we're talking about father-son relationship, and it was really on, it was kind of like oil and water. And I love my dad, man. My dad's a great guy. He's a hard butt. Anyway, I was at this retreat, and I laid it out to these three older guys that were at my Matt Talbot retreat. The one guy said, would you pay your VEPCO bill twice? I said, no. And he goes, right, because they wouldn't understand. The other guy said, you don't know I'm an amends. I was like, cool, there's two. The third guy goes, Mickey, how hard would it be for you to really sit down and make amends to your dad all over again? I'm like, son of a gun. So I planned this thing out. My dad's one of those really busybody guys. So I go over to his house. He's getting ready to go on this trip. And I sit him down at this table and I tell him what I'm doing. He seems very receptive. So I figure that he has had that conversation with his girlfriend and he And, you know, he knows that I know that what he said. So I went through everything. I went through everything that I could possibly think of. And at the end of it, I asked him, I said, now I have to ask you this question. I was like, is there anything that you're carrying inside of you that is troubling you that I may have either forgotten or may not even know about? Now would be the time to bring it up. Like, lay it on the table. I'm receptive to it. I'm, like, open to it. Like, whatever you want to bring to the table, I'm okay with it. And I just sat back. And that's one of the things that I've learned over time that I have to do with the recipients of my eighth and ninth step is I need them to have the opportunity to vent and talk. So my dad looked at me and he goes, nope. He goes, that's it. We're square. He goes, everything's good, all forgiven. So about a year goes by. We're over their house for Christmas, and we start talking about this stuff. And then when I had told him at the end, I said, now, you're not allowed to bring any of this stuff up in public anymore because we're square now. And I said, if we ever do, then I'm going to like raise these two fingers and let you know, no, we're square here, right? We already talked about this. So he starts going off at Christmas time. It's me and my wife, his girlfriend, and him. And he starts going off about this. And I said, hey, hold on a second. I was like, we already talked about this. You don't remember this? And he goes, nope. And I'm like, you're kidding me. And he goes, uh-uh. I'm like, fuming. I'm like, you mean to tell me that you are going to either deny or tell these two ladies that are sitting at this table that you do not remember me coming to this house and sitting you at this table and making these amends? He goes, I don't remember it. I could not freaking believe it. I mean, it was the most empty feeling that I had had in a long time. And then I got really mad. And I know that that's not probably the proper way to do it. But I told him, well, here's how this is going to go down. I'm like, I'm going to do this all over again right now. And I'm like, and I got two witnesses. So we're not going to have this conversation ever again. And we went through it all over again, through the whole thing right there. I made amends to my dad 3 times. I hope to God that, like, this one's done. I just want to share this one thing because it probably freed me more than anything else. Because, like, I know that men and their fathers and women and their mothers, they have certain issues. And I know for me that I'm so much like my dad, therein lies the issues. So anyway, I had worked for my dad for about 15 or 20 years, and I really did not like the way that he treated me a lot of the times. And over my sobriety, I had gone through the steps about every 18 months with a different person. In other words, a teacher would appear in my life, and I would ask them to walk me through the steps their way. And I was 17 years sober. I remember it like it was yesterday. Matter of fact, that's when this book got started, where I started writing the names and dates of everybody that I take through the book. And so this was in 2007. And here's all the people in the beginning of the book that I've taken through the book. And I don't say that to be bragging. I say that because it's living proof that that when you give AA back, AA really takes a hold of you in a different light. Anyway, this guy was taking me through the steps, and I got to the fourth step, and I had this resentment against my dad, and he said, well, let me ask you a question. He goes, why did you stay there? If you didn't like the way that your dad treated you or whatever, why did you stay there? And I said to him, well, because I had a great opportunity. It was a good job. And he goes, no, that's not it. And I'm like, well, I don't understand where you're getting at, so maybe you're just going to have to tell me. So he finally tells me, and he goes, you stayed there because it was easier. Right? I didn't understand that. But I stayed because it was easier. And like right there, the resentment left. Like I didn't have to resent my dad and hate my dad for the way that I treated him because the guy explained to me, you could have left anytime you wanted. You were not a slave to that company. They did not own you. You could have left any time you wanted. And I was like, holy smokes. I've been holding on to this stuff my whole life. And he like conquered it by telling me it was easier. Sometimes quickly, sometimes slowly.
Thank you.
All right. We got about 11 minutes left. I'll tell you what. I'm gonna read the rest of this, and y'all can talk on whatever part you want to do. Okay. Or the next reading picks up on page 83. Yes, there is a long period of reconstruction ahead. We must take the lead. A remorseful mumbling that we are sorry won't fill the bill at all. We ought to sit down with the family and frankly analyze the past as we now see it, being very careful not to criticize them. Their defects may be glaring, but the chances are that our own actions are partly responsible. So we clean house with the family, asking each morning in meditation that our Creator show us the way of patience, tolerance, kindliness, and love. The spiritual life is not a theory. We have to live it. Unless one's family expresses a desire to live upon spiritual principles, we think we ought not to urge them. We should not talk incessantly to them about spiritual matters. They will change in time. Our behavior will convince them more than our words. We must remember that 10 or 20 years of drunkenness would make a skeptic out of anyone. Next reading is on page 83. There may be some wrongs we can never fully right. We don't worry about them if we can honestly say to ourselves that we would write them if we could. Some people cannot be seen. We send them an honest letter. And there may be a valid reason for postponement in some cases, but we don't delay if it can be avoided. We should be sensible, tactful, considerate, and humble without being servile or scraping. As God's people, we stand on our own feet. We don't crawl before anyone. In the last reading, page 83, we are painstaking about this phase of our development. We will be amazed before we're halfway through. We're going to know a new freedom and a new happiness. We will not regret the past nor wish to shut the door on it. We will comprehend the word serenity and we will know peace. No matter how far down the scale we have gone, we will see our experience can benefit others. That feeling of uselessness and self-pity will disappear. We will lose interest in selfish things and gain interest in our fellows. Self-seeking will slip away. Our whole attitude and outlook upon life will change. Fear of people and of economic insecurity will leave us. We will intuitively know how to handle situations that used to baffle us. We will suddenly realize that God is doing for us what we could not do for ourselves. Are these extravagant promises? We think not. They are being fulfilled among us, sometimes quickly, sometimes slowly. They will always materialize if we work for them.
Yeah, I just want to be clear in case I wasn't before. Part of that living amends to my husband is not doing things like hiding names in my phone or pocketing my wedding band anymore. Yeah, so that's not a thing anymore. And that's another way I kind of rebuild that trust and that confidence as a wife. As far as wrongs we can never fully right, for me, that I also was not very kind to the people I dated in between. It was all about what I needed at the time and not about what they needed. And, it would not be great for me to run down any of my exes and to try to make amends to them. Their life is fine without me in it. As a matter of fact, at my workplace, I ran into a guy I dated for a couple months when I was not with my husband. And he was very nice. He said, hey, how are you doing? And he was with his wife. And it would not have been cool for me to say, hey, you know, I really need to talk to you. Do you remember a few years ago I chased you down like a dog and I put my hooks in you and then a couple months later I gave you the old heave-ho? That was wrong, you know? Like, they're fine. Probably better that I'm not in their life. So those are amends that I do not need to make, and that benefit that me not making those amends is going to benefit my husband and it's going to benefit those guys. So leave that alone. Another living amends that popped into my head during this reading is gossiping about people. If there's somebody at work who I talk about a lot behind their back, I don't need to go up to them and say, hey, I really need to get this off my chest. I talk about you behind your back a lot. I'm wrong. What I need to do is stop doing it. And it's not very easy. I justify, I say everybody's talking about them behind their back. They've done something that they deserve to be talked about behind their back. I need to vent. I can use all kinds of things. But the truth is, when I'm gossiping about somebody, I'm harming them. And how I can make amends to that person is to just not do it anymore. And that's a big step six thing, becoming willing to do something different. It has to become objectionable for me to take different action. And I can lie to myself all I want and say, oh, this isn't harming so-and-so, this isn't harming anybody but me, but you know, and that can go for me too. I can be really delusional and do something that genuinely only harms me, but until it becomes objectionable, I'm going to keep doing it. But there comes a time where it needs to stop, and I have to pray for willingness. And as far as the promises, every single one of these promises has come true for me at different parts of my sobriety. I don't get all of them every day, but using the gossiping as work at work as an example, it's kind of funny. I'm a very fearful person. I'm afraid of people. I'm afraid of being alone. I'm one of those. But, you know, I can go into work just riddled with fear. Like, oh my God, I'm just terrified of everybody at work. And it's kind of funny when I engage this living amends and I'm able to keep my mouth shut and not attack people's character behind their backs, that fear of people at work kind of slips away. Like the less I, the 12 and 12 calls it character assassination, the less I run my mouth, the more content I tend to be at work. And I'm just using work as an example. That can be anywhere. I can be AA or group of friends, anywhere. But my point is I don't stop gossiping to get the relief. The relief comes as a result. And yeah, the promises are definitely a thing. If you haven't experienced any, stick around. That'll pass.
So just real quickly, I had a financial amends that I couldn't make right because of certain circumstances. And there was another guy that was on my resentment list that had stole like a lot of money from me. And the same guy that helped me out with my dad, well, he really cornered me on that one. He said, here's what we're going to do. He said, you know that money that you owed that company that you can't pay back anymore? He said, if that guy ever comes to you and tells you that he wants to square up and pay you that money, you can't take it. He said, we're just going to call that, we just balanced the scales. I didn't like that so much. And about the promises, here's what I would like to sum up the promises as. Like, how can you take a guy that, when he came to AA, didn't want to be here? And now, like, you couldn't buy my seat in AA. And I kind of look at AA like, this is like so far removed from not drinking. It's more like, let's try to save a life, like one day at a time, over and over and over again. Because, you know, in the third step, like David always laughs about, the truth is, we really work for God. Mm-hmm. We do God's work. God works through us to help other people. Like, I don't do this stuff. God does it. But it is absolutely amazing when you watch it happen right in front of you. The miracles that happen in my life because of Alcoholics Anonymous through other people. Thanks for letting me share.
Thanks. Can we thank BJ and Mickey? You did awesome. You did awesome. I'm going to pass the seventh tradition baskets now. Our seventh tradition states that every AA group ought to be fully self-supporting, declining outside contributions. While contributions cover each group's rent and other expenses, the seventh tradition is essential at every level of AA service. It is both a privilege and a responsibility for groups and members to ensure that not only their group, but also their inner group, central office, local services, district, area, and general service office remain self-supporting. This keeps AA free of outside influences that might divert us from our primary purpose, to help the alcoholic who still suffers. The amount of our contribution is secondary to the spiritual connection that unites all groups around the world. Are there any AA-related announcements?
Hey, Larry. My home group, AA 101, will be having its happy anniversary. Brunch. It's at Norfolk Center. Brunch is at 10. You can bring some fruit if you wish. We have, I think, bacon, sausage, pancakes, punch.
Yeah.
And yeah, we've got a juice bar. And brunch is at 10, and the meeting will start at 11. A speaker is coming down from Maryland. His name is Justin A. And I heard he has a great story, so come hang with us. Oh, June 25th. I don't know if I said that. Okay. June 25th.
Thank you. My name is BJ. I'm an alcoholic.
We did.
Monday, July 10th, this home group is having supper and a speaker. We'll do supper at 6 p.m. potluck, bring a dish if you wish. At 7 p.m. Mike T. from Richmond will be sharing. We'd love to see you guys. Thanks.
Thank you. Any other AA-related announcements? Right. Simple Actions is a home group. If you're interested in joining our home group, please see one of us after the meeting. Home group members, could you raise your hands? All right. Newcomers, is there anyone here in their first 30 days of sobriety? If you could please introduce yourself by your first name so we can get to know you.
Hey, Travis.
Hey, Travis. Welcome. Anyone else? All right. We do have a literature table over there. The books are have a cost, but the pamphlets are free. Sponsorship. Sponsorship in AA is yours for the asking. We urge you, do not delay. Anyone willing to be a sponsor, please raise your hand. If you have questions or would like to additional information about sponsorship in AA, just come up to the table after the meeting and I'll be happy to answer any of your questions. Reminder, smokers, I know it's raining outside, but please stay away from the front door and so the smoke doesn't get in the church or bother the church members that are here. All meetings at this meeting, or all meeting audio recordings and upcoming events, are posted on our website, which is simpleactions.net. In closing, can we thank the panel one more time? And after we clean up, all are invited and encouraged to continue the conversation on the step discussed tonight at the meeting after the meeting, which I think will be back at Plaza del Sol tonight. As far as we're, all right, it's right up on 22nd and Colonial. Come join us. And could someone please read the last couple paragraphs? Thank you, Leah.
My name is Leah, and I am an alcoholic.
Hey, Leah. We'll close now with the Lord's Prayer.
here.
Our Father,
who art in heaven,